is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. One should, for example, be able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Dialogue.
Ho! Hey, guys, we're on the air. This is Terry D. Kester. Welcome to Dialogue. Tonight we have, again, the Raucous Caucus. And
I like that name.
Yeah, well, actually, that was a show that I did years ago with Chuck Shepard, if you remember him. He's the guy that writes News of the Weird. And believe it or not, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor. And it was he's a very funny guy, trust me, short and funny. Anyway, but I think
that gives us something to aspire to there.
Aspire to, well.
Right.
I would take a cabinet secretary post when that's offered.
And, you know, we can aspire to using the name Raucous Caucus, and then we can try to meet the bar bill that we had while doing the show, too.
Which, you're not supposed to talk about that, Terry.
Oh, okay. All right.
You mean we're supposed to wait till after the show to start drinking?
Sometimes. You know, I mean, just try not to spill it on the microphone. That's all we ask.
Okay.
This is Terry D. Kester, and this is
Garland Nixon
and Mark Levine.
And it's good to see you guys again. It was lonely in here last week without you guys, but somehow that we managed. Yeah, we managed. You know, but we had the callers to help us, and we had T to help us. So you know, I mean, what
and
more
when
can
T
we?
And T is behind
the board,
everything
safe.
Works.
We're safe.
And when
we're
he's
safe.
Not there. Sometimes
everything works.
If you hear a dial tone during the show, that means that T is not on the board.
Right. But if you hear, never mind. We won't go into that. Anyway. There's tons of stuff going on all over the place, as you know, and what we're going to talk about tonight, because I know that we can have fun with it, and we can have callers call in at 202-588-0893, but not yet unless you want to wait a while. But first, I got to hear Mark's opinion, I got to hear Garland's opinion, and of course, they're dying to hear my opinion. You know, I mean, that's really the essence of the whole evening. You know,
as you were saying, Ted.
As I was saying. Okay, simple facts. You know, it seems to me, gentlemen, that that we've just lost control of our government. I mean, we the people. You know, the lobbyist has grown into such a systematized, organized, institutionalized, corporate, powerful entity that, you know, we the people just really don't have the influence, the power, the voice that we would hope for that we need. And there was a fascinating study that was partly done by the Washington Post and partly done in cooperation with the Center for Responsive Politics, and it was in the Washington Post on Monday. Absolutely fascinating and frightening. Let me just read you a couple of bits from that. Washington Post reported that insurers, pharmaceutical companies, medical associations, and hospitals have hired more than 350 former government staff members and retired members of Congress as part of a $1.4 million a day lobbying campaign. $1.4 million a day.
And people wonder where they use the money
that
we spend on health care.
Right.
I mean, you know, people complain about high health care costs, but they're going to good use.
Yeah,
when
lobbyists.
You buy those $100 pills, you're buying probably a lobbyist, right?
Probably, well, you know,
a small percentage of a lobbyist.
Yeah, you got to buy a lot of pills to get up $1.4 million a day.
I understand.
That's a lot of pills, as you and I know, Mark. Anyway.
Speak for yourself. I'm not Rush Limbaugh here. I don't have an Oxycontin habit like you do, Terry.
Hey. What do we say? Never mind. All right. We're going to be serious here, guys. We're going to accomplish great things. We're going to share information. The attitude of the pharmaceuticals and everything else is this amount of money, $1.4 million a day, quote, you know, is a small cost of doing business, you know, relative to the profits that they can garner. As an example of lobbying, I mean, it's already, you know, in action now. The healthcare thing is still, you know, being debated and still being bought, I mean, negotiated.
Bought.
The energy bill, climate bill, as you know, was already passed, and that was now, it's now up to 1,400 pages of loopholes.
You're right.
And
I was
special
about to say.
Exceptions. 1,400 pages added in by every congressman, every senator, just adding them in, you know, at the request of private industry, at the request of whomever, to actually, and what has gone from the auction of the carbon. Offset carbon auctions from 100% auction down to only 15% will be auctioned now. All the rest is just going to be paid for by you and me. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. It's that simple. Anyway, to press on with the lobbying idea, just to give you an idea, former Senate leaders Bob Dole, Republican Kansas, Tom Daschle, Democrat South Dakota, as well as one-time House leaders Richard Armory, Republican of Texas, Richard Gephardt, Democrat Missouri, work for lobbying firms retained by, you guessed it, health product companies, or have lobbied directly for them. Former Representative Billy Tauzin, Republican Louisiana, is president and CEO of the Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers of America, PhRMA. PhRMA, by the way, which has its headquarters, if you haven't noticed, right next to the Federal Reserve, which I always thought was, you know, kind of wise.
That way they can just grab the money and run.
Yeah, grab the money and run, and it saves time, saves minimum. They
can do it like, you know, when you have like a lot of friends that go to get hotel rooms, and you just have a door where you open and walk through so you can kind of meander back.
That's all
they need is a door with the Federal Reserve, they can just kind of put the money on it.
It's basically a sealed and private building. We don't get to see the tunnels over to the you know, anyway. And more than that, Post notes that nearly half of the 350 insiders previously worked for key committees and lawmakers, including Senators Max Baucus, Democrat Montana, Charles Grassley, Republican Iowa, and the Senate Finance Committee's chairman and ranking members, respectively. Just to give you an idea of how things work on the Hill, in case you had any doubt, here's a little description of a meeting last month that demonstrates the close ties among powerful congressional staffers and their former colleagues turned lobbyists. June 10th reunion featured two former Baucus chiefs of staff, two of them, David Castagnetti and Jeffrey Forbes, as well as a former aide to Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat, Connecticut, and Richard Tarplin, Castagnetti's firm. Melvin Vogel Castagnetti is retained by America's Health Insurance Plans, one of the public auction's staunchest opponents, and PhRMA and a handful of doctors' groups, all of these groups meeting together on the behalf of PhRMA. Tarplin's lobby shop, Tarplin Strategies, has received $60,000 this year from the American Medical Association, a mere pittance. And, of course, the American Medical Association and the lobbyists there are a vocal critic of the president's health plan. That just gives you a little quick rundown. The Washington Post has many more. I mean, it goes on forever. I mean, you can see just by the yellow marks on this page here of, you know, how much is going on by the lobbyists. It's absolutely incredible, not just a revolving door, but the influence that is literally being bought and paid for and the effect that it's having on every legislative product, whether or not Obama is a man of principle and is willing to fight these through or whether he can in this given circumstance. But the issue to me, gentlemen, is our government's out of our control.
Well, and speaking of the Washington Post, journalism is out of our control.
You noticed that.
Yes, because for all the fact that you're relying on the Washington Post for your data, let's not forget that the Washington Post came very close to being bought off themselves. In a scandal that happened just this week, the new publisher of the Washington Post, the granddaughter of the famed Katharine Graham, who I dare say would never ever have allowed this to happen, was caught with her finger in the cookie jar. She was going to have these wonderful salons, of course, in her home, $25,000 a pop, or you can buy a book of 10 for a quarter mil.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they get a little bargain there, maybe $240,000, whereby lobbyists could meet off the record with journalists and with politicians. They already, you know, can pay to meet with politicians, but now they can actually meet with journalists, influence the press, all entirely off the record, to convince the Washington Post to spin things their way. And as we all know, the fourth estate, the fourth branch of government, the press, is very important. And this is something that probably would have happened if not for the intrepid blog Politico.com coming out with it. And the Washington Post quickly apologized and said, oops, yeah, we didn't really realize we were doing this. Sorry, we won't do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely amazing. And I mean, it was not only the journalist and not only the lobbyist, but it also included at least invites to, whether they had been accepted or not, is not sure, to send Senator Feinstein, and you know, people that you wouldn't think would normally be engaged in something like this, but at least were invited. Whether or not their offices accepted, we don't know for sure.
And the thing I have to wonder with something like that, when we hear about something like that, you know, there's very few things are new in Washington, D.C.
You notice that.
And when you hear something like that that's happened, you have to suspect that this has been happening, may
well,
have been
actually,
happening.
Actually, to follow up on yeah, that, the Atlantic Magazine, after this came out with the Washington Post, came clean with the fact that they've been doing it for the last 6 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. So as I was saying, it appears to me that in all likelihood, someone finally got caught, something that goes on behind closed doors on a fairly regular basis. We found out about
and
it.
And to be clear, even
so they'll get better at hiding it now, basically.
And I want to be clear, I have no problem with private gatherings of reporters and lobbyists and politicians, but they have to be on the record. The idea that the reporters can learn all this stuff off the record and be influenced for money, that I got a real problem
with. And
if you read her editorial apology, you know, I mean, she really, not only did she backpedal like crazy, but she basically said, you know, in so many words, we're going to go ahead and do this anyway. We're just going to be a little more careful about it, a little more.
Well, I think she promised to do it on the record, and that's a very important distinction. Yeah. Actually, I don't have a problem with
it. Well, I said open.
Open.
But it's not going to stop the salon. It's not going to stop the hobnobbing. And, you know, one
and
of the
paying
things,
for it. And the question is, do you get what you pay for? You know, it's one of the things that.
Always the question.
I mean, you were mentioning all these other staffers. I'm an ex-staffer myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not working for Big Pharma. Think of all the millions. What am I doing behind this microphone? I need to get
it's
out
all the
there.
Millions you're making here, Mark.
Some of our listeners wonder that, too, but we don't want to get into that.
There you go. But T's just loving that behind them. But no, but the thing is that here are these staffers, and you have to wonder what people are getting for their money. If they're spending $500 million, you know, I take 350 times 1.4 million a day, 365 days in a year, it's $500 million of what would ostensibly be their profits. And they have to justify it to their shareholders. There's only two possibilities. Either they're throwing money out the window for nothing, which I don't think is likely for profits, and I don't think their shareholders would be very happy with that, or they're basically practicing legalized bribery.
Yeah. Let me just give you an example, and that was in the previous administration, but the seniors bill for
the drug bill.
Donuts. Right. One of the things that happened was there was a provision put in there that the government was not allowed to bargain with the drug companies for prices for the prices. Now, people who were already on medical assistance could bargain with the drug companies and get lower prices. But when they brought that bill in, all the people who were on medical assistance now came under Medicare, and now those who formerly could bargain with the drug companies and get better prices couldn't do it. So the reality is this, and they made billions off of that.
Yeah.
The reality is this.
Well, and plus there's a lot of tax money that went to them too.
Yeah, so the reality is this. If you're a big pharmaceutical company and you're investing money here and there and here and there, you can invest on 50 or 60 bills. You get one good one through. One!
Yeah.
And you make billions, you make all your money back. So it's in their best behalf to keep going after bill after bill after bill. Every now and then they're going to get a good one, and they're going to make 25 years worth of profit.
Yeah, and in that case particularly, they actually, I mean, you know, it was practically admitted by the administration and by Congress. The pharma basically wrote that bill.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
You know,
like the energy companies wrote the bill where Dick Cheney would not even say who he's meeting with.
Right.
They're paying billions of dollars from their lobbying funds to meet with him, and Cheney won't. I'm not going to tell you who met with me and wrote the bill.
The thing I always wondered about that, not to get off subject, is what the strange thing about it is this. We don't have any privacy because they can look at our mail and read our email.
That's right.
Now the government has privacy.
Right.
We can't know what they're doing.
Right. Now, we can't know who paid whom, but they
can know everything about us. I thought it was supposed to be the other way around.
With a thought, so. In fact, I see Mark's got his copy of the Constitution here.
I do. I carry it with me wherever I go, and it's always important to read it because people are always surprised by what nuggets we find in here. And today's constitutional learning, my friends, is from Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, in which it says, "The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." In other words, only treason, bribery, and high crimes. It's one of the big three, bro. And yet, this is daily politics in Washington.
Why do I have a feeling that Mark's going to start singing something about "I'm just a bill sitting on Capitol Hill"?
that's we do that off mic, Garland. We all talk about this.
So the question
education
becomes,
rock or whatever it was. go ahead.
But the question becomes, you know, what the hell can we do about it?
Public financing.
Well, yeah.
Two
okay.
words.
Yeah,
I do it two words.
No question about it. So what's our chance of getting that through? I mean, the real question I'm asking is, how do you fight this power? How do you get around
this power? A polar bear's chance in the Arctic in 100 years?
In 100 years?
50 years? 20 years?
Did you know the United States Navy is already planning the routes through the Arctic Circle?
I know.
Yeah. I'm serious. The shipping lanes are already being planned through the Arctic Circle. And poor Russia's all worried because they won't be able to hide their submarines under the ice because there won't be any.
There just won't be any humans alive to actually run the ships.
We're getting off topic here.
Well, no, but the point is that European states do it. It's not like democracies can't handle it. England, France, Netherlands, you name it. I think Canada, too. I need to double check that. I'm not sure. Maybe one of our Canadian callers can let me know.
Could be.
But my understanding, I know it's true for Europe. I'm not sure about Canada. I think it is true for Canada. We'll find out. But virtually every Western democracy has a form of public financing because they understand that with money comes access and power and bribery. And the sad thing about it is that it's legal. I don't think it is because the Constitution says it isn't. Yeah. But nonetheless, this kind of stuff is commonplace. And what the politicians say is, oh, they're not paying me to write it their way. They're just paying to talk to me. Well, if they're supposed to be representing all of us, none of us should have to pay to talk to a politician. All of us should be able to walk through the front door and lobby. See, I'm not against lobbying per se.
No, me neither. I mean, you know, if you've got an expert who's worked in healthcare or has worked
in Congress
and
wants to talk for free to the politician,
you know, or even if it's a paid lobbyist, if there were somehow, you know,
if they're giving money to the member of Congress,
that's the catch. That's right. If it were a paid lobbyist and he's a professional and he represents a pharmaceutical and equal access is given to a guy that represents the Medicare patients and senior citizens from ARP or whatever, that's fine.
Right.
And that expertise is needed. There's no question
and
about
if
that.
If there was public finance, we wouldn't have to worry about
it.
Then they could listen to all the arguments of all the people and actually pick the best arguments in the way democracy is supposed to work.
That'd be nice.
Yeah,
so
never
how do we get past them or around them or through them or over them? Garland, solve the problem for us.
Yeah, please, Garland. Solve the problem for us. Can you do it in about two minutes? Because we got to take some calls soon.
No, I wish I had the answer. But the reality is it's been here for a while. And I think this was part of what this was part of the whole, not to go back to the Obama movement. One of the things President Obama said at the time that he was on the campaign trail was that people needed to be brought back into the process. People needed to be brought back to the process in Washington. They were out. So I think people who really aren't even into politics, people intuitively realize and can see that they don't have a voice anymore. And I think everybody wants a voice. The question is, and I say even with President Obama coming in, is he going to be able to penetrate this monster that's here? Part of the issue too is this. For the most part, we've created a system where if you want to get elected, you got to have the $50 million or something in your war chest. The average Joe can't get it. The only way to get it is from these humongous companies who can generate this money.
Right. So super rich millionaires who made money from the system. Either way, what's your choice? It's like Ross Perot said, I can't be bought. And it's like, but how much money did you steal?
So in order to get in office, you have to get this exorbitant amount of money. The only way to get this amount of money is from these groups that want all the interest. So the average person or the average a person who's supported by the people under normal circumstances doesn't have a chance to get in.
Does this mean that Bernie Madoff, even though he's in prison, can run for office?
I don't think a felon.
No,
well, I don't think he'll win.
You can't be an active. You've got to be a retired felon
I don't know. No, I don't know. I mean,
there's plenty of felons.
There are people that have been in jail that have actually probably served. I don't know. He probably could.
Well, I've met some.
But let me suggest something else. I think public financing is right now a tough sell in America politically. We gotta be honest about the pragmatics of it. For some reason, Americans say, "Oh no, they're going to tax me," not understanding that their taxes go way up when the pharmaceutical companies pass a bill that requires them to be taxed trillions of dollars to pay for them. That it's a lot cheaper to pay millions of dollars. Maybe a buck for each of us, $300 million for public financing. But I do have at least a way partly to get from here to there. And that is to ban corporate giving. Let me make an argument here. When citizens bond together to form interest groups, whether it be interest groups that I support, pro-choice interest groups, civil rights interest groups, or interest groups I detest, the NRA, pro-life interest groups, whatever, Focus on the Family. But when individual citizens band together, then I think that an argument can be made if they give money to politicians who support their views, that's not as bad as corporations. And the reason why corporations are more severe is it's not their money. They're playing with other people's money. If you believe in pro-life or pro-choice and you give money, okay, you're putting your money where your mouth is.
Right.
Corporations, though, are spending someone else's money, not for their individual interests, but to help pad the corporate pockets. And it seems to me that if the CEO of a corporation wants to give from his own pocket, from his wallet, I can deal with that too. But when they spend corporate funds, either, as I said before, either they're buying something for nothing, in which case it's wasting Cheryl's money.
There's a huge difference.
Yeah. Or what's really happening, if they're getting something for what they're buying,
bribery.
It's pure bribery.
And there's a huge obvious difference too. I mean, if you take something like Focus on the Family or the ACLU or whatever, I mean, they're obviously representing a cause and a position.
Exactly.
And even if they win...
Or farmers or doctors or anyone else. Yeah. Right. Or individuals.
Yeah. And if they win or get something passed through because of their influence, you know, what do they gain personally? I mean, practically nothing.
Whereas no money interest, they gain their belief.
They gain their belief, exactly. Whereas a corporation is always in a position to gain monetarily, in terms of policy, et cetera, for a direct profit to the corporation. Always. I mean, you can't, it's impossible to have a situation where that's not true.
Which is why most states ban corporate giving, and technically it's not supposed to happen in Congress, but they get through all kinds of a million loopholes.
And the other thing that people got to be aware of, and this really is scary too, I mean, we're all aware of the lobby effort in Washington, D.C. Now, what has happened, obviously, in the last few years, there's been a slight shift almost in terms of federalism, but the states have actually taken a lot more steps in terms of social problems and tax problems and even criminal problems than the federal government has. Well, of course, now the lobbying effort has spread to the states and is an extraordinary. I mean, the same kind of, you know, absurdity in terms of money, I mean, not on the same level because it's not as big and as powerful, but every state, and a few years ago, there were no state lobbyists out there. Now every state house is packed with lobbyists again. And we see that whether it's in tobacco problems or whatever it's in, it's happening all over the country. So they have not only centralized here in Washington, they've spread out to every single state.
Well, the question is, are people angry enough about it? You know, are people concerned enough about it? And unfortunately right now, you know, the answer is no. Of course, we always run into that issue of a corporation being a person that I'm not too crazy about.
It ain't in here. Yeah. I'm flipping through my constitution, and it's just not there, folks.
Somewhere in the back notes, I don't see it.
I don't see it in there. But with the state lobbyists, then, of course, becomes a race to the bottom. You have places like Delaware with its corporate law, and South Dakota, which allows interest rates
of 90%.
Right, so they go to South Dakota, corporations go to Delaware, and these tiny states end up with the race to the bottom controlling all of us. There's a reason why Citibank is headquartered in South Dakota, and yet Citibank, I don't think of the great cities, metropolises of South Dakota.
They don't actually advertise that a whole lot either.
You don't really see the planes and the weeds.
Hey, Mark, wasn't there a mention or something here recently of some legislation to address that?
Yes.
You're probably a little familiar.
But you know the catch on that legislation. I mean, this disgusts me in terms of Obama and everybody else. The legislation is passed, yes, to place some limits on credit cards. It doesn't go into effect until February. All of the credit card companies are already raising their rates, raising their fees, et cetera. It won't be grandfathered. So they've got all this time.
They're going to get you now.
They're setting up everything they want, unchecked, unregulated, before the bill goes into effect.
How could Obama have signed that? What I was talking about was the consistency.
Well, it's better than nothing. Yeah. Starting in February.
Yeah, right. They've already picked my pocket and beaten up my mother.
But they've been picking your pocket and beating up your mother for the last 50 years, Terry.
But what I was mentioning, Mark, was the consistency. There was something in there. Wasn't there something in there about a consistency between amongst the states? The corporate laws. I don't know why that keeps coming. There was a discussion of that here recently.
To change it
so they couldn't all have separate laws on corporations.
Well, I don't know about corporations, but for credit cards, there's supposed to be a new federal standard that'll come in February. Until we see the regs, it's not clear exactly what it's going to do. One of the things, though, that Obama's trying to push through, and I don't think it's gone into effect yet, but I think would be a really good idea, is a financial protection agency, like the environmental protection
agency. Yeah, which again is being fought by the financial
industry. Very hard.
But to have
a consumer advocate in the White House, I mean, for all that I dislike about Ralph Nader.
But do you realize how sad it is to have to say that?
I know, it is sad. You would think the president would be our consumer advocate.
Like having a citizen advocate. You know?
Well, we need it.
I know.
Mr. Smith needs to go to Washington.
So we
do need it. And it's something that I think would make a major difference, because then you'd have one organization designed to protect consumers from the rapacious companies.
So we're still stuck with the problem now. we're still stuck with the problem. We know some of the solutions. We've discussed some
solutions. Can we ask some of our callers for
answers? We will get some of our callers to give solutions as well. But how do we get the public to move? That's the big question that concerns me the most. Whether it's this issue or any other issue, how do we get the public, who seems sedated,
yes,
to the nth degree at this point? They will not get off their butts. They'll Twitter, but they will not get off their butts and get out there and say, look, we demand, we need, we want. There's never been social change in this country without that kind of physical activist movement. And I don't see us, I don't know what it takes to get us out there anymore.
Let's give out the phone numbers and let our callers join us.
You think they've got the answers? I hope so. Okay, because you've got
they can't do any worse than us.
Yeah, you got three geniuses here, but it's just not working, guys. We haven't got the answers. 202-588-0893. We are discussing the state of our government. We are discussing lobbyists. We are discussing the idea of public financing of the elections, which would do so much to remove the problem. But the big question is not only the specific solution or the specific legislation, but how in heaven's name do we get the public motivated to do something? Because if they don't do it, they don't empower Obama or anybody else to make the change.
You know, Terry, I remember in 2006, just before the Democrats took over Congress, it seems like every single day in the newspaper there would be a story about Jack Abramoff, a story about Tom DeLay or Doolittle or Duke Cunningham, yeah, the guy in San Diego,
good old Duke.
Right, yeah. who was stupid enough to actually say, all right, for $12,000, I'll give you this $1 million, and for $20,000, I'll give you $2 million. Right. I mean, don't spell it out, Duke. Just whisper it. Don't write it down. Anyway, but there was, of course, a story every minute, and it's largely because of that, and then maybe some other things like Mark Foley and a few other things, but. It's the Republican corruption in Congress has largely been credited for the Democrats' victory in 06 and to some extent for Obama's victory in 08. Now, the question is, what are the Democrats doing now that they're in charge?
Not
and they're doing
much.
A little. But not near as much as they could do. And so the question is I think, unfortunately, it's going to take another scandal of that magnitude, another trip to Scotland with some Democratic lawmakers before people will get out there again.
Right. And the other thing is this, what we're looking at is, you know, it's like when people say term limits and things like that. A lot of times people want to look at it as though it's the people. It's not the people. If you change, this is a systemic problem.
A system, absolutely.
So if you change out the players in the game, in a game of chess, you can color the pieces any way you want. You still got a game of chess. So the issue we have, and again, it gets back to what Terry's saying, until the people get upset, until the people get behind it and push for systemic changes, nothing going to, you know, we're just kind of yelling in the wind a lot.
I think maybe what we have to do, guys, is, you know, we have to have this dialogue edition. We have to have the raucous caucus here. When we really get worked up, we have to take it out to the streets. You know, we have to go out there with bullhorns. And all our listeners got to line up, and we just got to head out and do some stuff. You know, I mean, I don't know what else it's
going to
take.
I think we have to invade political operatives. Because if you talk to a political operative about any race, anywhere, what – they'll tell you. I mean, what's that famous phrase? Money is the mother's milk of politics, mm-hmm. which I've always found a little gross, honestly.
But doesn't fit with my image. But anyway.
I think that's the point, that it is a little gross.
Yes,
and
it
they'll
is.
Tell anyone, if you're interested in running for office, okay, can you raise me $1 million? And you're like, well, don't you want to hear my ideas? And they're like, no.
Oh, I
know. Can you raise me $5 million over 3 weeks? And I can change the world. I have this great solution to the environmental crisis. You raise me $1 million? No. Okay. Goodbye.
Yeah. A few years ago, I thought about running for a delegate for the Virginia State Legislature. And I spoke with Leslie Byrne and some others who were very supportive and very wonderful about running for office. And finally, of course, I got the numbers that I had to call in the Democratic Party. And the first question was, how much money do you have and how much money can you raise?
Absolutely.
That's all we care about.
And that's not unique to Virginia. That is in every jurisdiction.
Of course.
City, local, federal, state, everywhere in the United States. That is the first question a political operative will ask you.
Yeah. And it's disgusting. It really is. Hey, we got to take a break here, and we got a PSA announcement that's very important, and I guess I should read this mandatory line. No, I don't know. This is different. There's two elections coming up, and you got to read part of this, and the other part you're going to hear on a PSA as we take our break. break. Just remember, you got up through July 15th for WPFW recruiting listener members like you to become candidates for the local station board.
And you don't even need money for that.
That's right. And you go to the front page of the WPFW website or at WPFW.org. Download the forms needed to run in the election. You can also get nomination forms here at the station. And you got to be returned those forms if you want to run for the board here to actually have some say in how WPFW develops. And as you know, WPFW is in a very developmental period here. You got to have them in by July 15th. So come on in, sign up, help your station. Contact Lydia Harris if you need to have questions answered. She's the election coordinator. You can call her at 202-588-099, extension 308. So that's to become a member of the local station board.
And that's real democracy, friends, not bought democracy.
Right. And you're also going to hear a PSA here about the advisory board. That's a different board. There's a couple of elections coming up, so understand these are two different things. We'll take that break. We'll be right back with your calls.
Let's get the number just before we go.
The call-in number, of course, is 202-588-0893. Okay.
Join us this Wednesday, July 8th at 11 a.m. for Africa Now. This week, the program focuses on President Obama's first trip to sub-Saharan Africa and the coup in Honduras and its impact on Afro-descendants in that Central American nation. Africa Now, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. here on WPFW 89.3 FM.
Try it out for size. Your business. Got a handful of gimmies shining in them bloodshot eyes. You live a life like you play gin rummy. Tenner get you 20, you only in it for the money, baby. Only in it for the money, honey.
All right. We're back here. Only in it for the money. That's not Mark. That's not Garland. And that's not me.
No, Terry that's just the U.S. government.
That's the U.S. government. That's the Senate, the congressman, the lobbyist. Oh, brother. Anyway, we're looking for answers. The number is 202-588-0893. We have a couple of people on the phone ready and eager to go. Sam, I believe you're first up. This is Terry. Talk to us. Hello, Sam. How are you? Are you there? Yes.
Yeah.
What do we do, Sam? Go ahead. What do we do?
Talk to us.
Okay. Well, I have one solution which doesn't get very much traction because it's not a very attractive, item to sell, but it's approval voting. I think until we get to a point where we can realistically have a third party, we don't have any chance of getting any of the stuff done that we're talking about. But, you know, approval voting, for those who are not mathematicians, is basically instead of one vote per person. It's each person votes one time for everyone they approve of, and the person with the most votes at the end wins.
It's sort of an instant, same as instant runoff, isn't it?
No, it's very different, actually. In terms of voting systems, it's the only...
It's where you rank them, first, second, third, and fourth.
I thought you said Iowa. That as well,
what they do in Iowa.
No, first, second, third, and fourth. Just yes or no, up and down.
Oh, that's another way to do it.
Okay.
And the number of yeses wins. And the reason that's more fair, I mean, is as opposed to any of those other methods, is because there are no situations where you have to choose between what you really want to happen politically and what you think can happen. So with the whole like Bush election, there were a lot of people who didn't want Bush in office, but didn't think think that their candidate could win. And, you know, so it's like you take the whole idea of whether or not a candidate is viable out when you just say, I want him in office or I don't. And so for all those people that like a candidate, they don't vote for him and he can't get in.
All right, Sam, this is a great idea. This is a great idea. How do we get the public, you know, where are you locally that you could even get this instituted locally, do you think?
Well,
where do you live?
The first thing about it would be to get it started on local elections. Because obviously, on the national political scene, they're very comfortable not having to listen to any of their constituents. But if you started on local elections and got up to the point where D.C. council and mayoral elections were happening on an approval basis, then it would be a lot harder for people, the fat cats at the top, to defend a system that is statistically unfair. If all of the smaller sections of the government are using it.
All right, Sam, that's a good idea, and you know I think that's something that I don't know if it could be accomplished locally. Well, sure, of course it could be accomplished locally. It's got more chance of being accomplished locally, you know, than it does on a national level. But you could build something that could grow there, and I think that's something similar. I'm not sure.
D.C. has at-large elections, so it'd actually be very easy for something like that because they're nonpartisan.
Right. Yeah. You could do that, and I know that in Scotland they have either instant runoff or approval voting. I'm not sure which, but I know they've done that in other countries, and it's working very, very well. And, of course, part of that whole thing that we talked about, too, because it's got to be realistic in trying to limit the financing or getting rid of the financing of elections, you know, we've got to somehow either open up the TV and the media so that there is not this – I mean –
They make a huge amount of money off this.
They make something like 50% of their profit off of elections.
And you got to remember that they exist because of the FCC. All right? The only reason TV and radio, including WPFW, the only reason we exist is because we have this little niche, 89.3 FM, on the radio dial, and no one else is allowed by law to broadcast in this area at that place. If they did, they could drown out our signal. We'd have a huge mess. That kind of thing is parsed by the FCC. They decide everywhere on the radio dial, everywhere on the TV dial, everywhere on the cable dial. That is our public airwaves. We should get some money back for it. And
we
one
should
of
get
the
some
things
money
that
back.
They can get, we can get for it is require them to have a certain amount of time devoted to every candidate for public office.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that hard because like we're already required to give equal time. If I bring some candidate on, if you guys, you know, if we bring a candidate on, we got to give equal time. Now, there's no reason we could just not, frankly, the pressure of the FCC start to eliminate commercials entirely, but every candidate can be heard. They can have debates like they have and broadcast that, but none of this paid stuff. This is billions of dollars. And that's one of the reasons the congressman, even if he's a good congressman, you know, he's trapped because if he doesn't spend those billions for the television commercials, or she, right, exactly.
And they're in the middle of a game, and if you don't play the game, guess what happens?
That's right.
You lose,
that's
you're
right.
out. So there are, there's just this system that's, how in the world do you fix this? Because the people that are in the middle of it, either one of two things. Either they want to fix it, but they know if they try to do anything, they're going to get tossed out, and they're not even going to be in the group that can fix it, or they're making out so well from it that they don't want to touch it.
Yeah, it's sad. But I think you know, starting on a local level, and with Sam, like Sam's specific idea actually has some traction to it. So let's check with Ken. Ken, you know, how do we get people motivated? How do we get a change happening? Because you know it has to happen. We know it has to happen. Tell us.
Well, first, let me just comment on what I think is the main reason that a lot of folks aren't really moved to action. I think so many people are pretty much marginalized, you know, and you know, just at the point of just trying to make ends meet, that they care about the issues. And I think at some level they're aware of the issues and want to do something about it, but they're so caught up into the daily grind of, you know, everything. And I think, you know, when we talk about, you know, the American culture here, the corporate culture here, I think, you know, in some ways, whether it's intentionally implemented and instituted or not, you know, pretty much the burden of personal investment has fallen onto, you know, the worker and, you know, people on the lower rungs of the economic scale. I think, you know, personally, I mean, I think one of the important things that people have got to learn to do is to organize economically. The political organization is great, and, you know, and we have a good tradition and, you know, a lot of institutions and avenues and vehicles to do that, but we have got to learn to organize economically, you know, with things like cooperative, you know, cooperative type of efforts, you know, and you know, I don't think enough of that is emphasized, you know, to basically, you know, how people basically then learn how to organize and invest in institutions that are going to feed directly back into their own communities and their own vested interests. And I wanted to say one more thing, that, you know, I think we, you know, if we're talking about, you know, corporate and, you know, and more or entities or, you know, institutions directly linked to communities, we need to change our perception of government from being this big entity in the sky, the overseeing entity in the sky, is, you know, something that belongs to us and that we have control of it. Because the only thing that's really going to marginalize, you know, the corporate power that's taking hold in this country is basically the power of the critical mass. You know, people coming right. together in mass, you know, demanding something different. And if you notice, and I've noticed and observed that the only time things move, you know, in the direction of the, you know, more populist type of solutions and type of, you know, approaches to problems is when you have a critical mass of individuals that come together and make enough noise and, you know, force these folks and hold them to hold their feet to the fire.
And I guess that's
a good example of that.
You're right, Ken. And I mean, I guess that's part of the thing that still keeps me perplexed. I mean, right now there's, you know, one third of our population is underinsured or uninsured. Now, if that ain't a critical mass, I don't know what the hell is. You know, I don't know what it takes. You know, healthcare is kind of exceptional, I think, because it's, you know, when we've talked about it on the air here, you know, that it's sort of an individual thing. It happens to you individual. It's very intimate, and it's not, it doesn't seem as political as, in fact, it is. You know, so maybe that's one of the reasons that people don't get up and march about this. And besides, if you're sick or dying or in the hospital,
you're not in a good position to march.
You know, but maybe if enough local movement started, be it on a cooperative level, like Ken was suggesting, or Sam was suggesting earlier, on a local level, you can get some kind of momentum going, because we've got to get the momentum going.
And let's not forget the institutions that already exist, that already organize at the bottom level. Of course, labor unions, which are weaker than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. But they are around, they exist, and they're a great way to actually make things happen in Washington based on the grassroots efforts.
And that's one thing that astounds me, too. I don't know how it is that so many people got educated or believed or inculcated that labor unions somehow or other are not good for the general welfare of the society. I don't know how the hell that happened.
A lot of corporate money.
You think?
Yeah.
You think? Could it be? All right. Let's go to our next caller. Our next caller is RG. RG, this is Terry and Mark and Garland. Welcome.
Oh, great. Okay, gentlemen, how are you?
Wonderful. How are you doing?
We're fine, RG.
Fine, just fine. As I stated to Terry last week, all in affectational jest. I feel as though I'm going before an en banc panel. So comes now the appellant holding for rules prohibiting any statement not accepted by the court.
That's okay. You don't have to call us Your Honor either. Just tell us in plain words.
Okay. Back to the case at point.
Okay.
You know, the thing that most people in the electorate are going to respond to. If you look at it from a psychological perspective, threats or pay value, you know, people get up when there's a pin sticking in their butt, basically, and start moving, or they step on a nail, you know. And
they get laid off.
Right. And so, you know, that it also depends, I think, guys, on what you're trying to get done, if it's health care, if it's, you know, housing, if it's, you know, whatever the agenda is, it generally is going to determine how much of a groundswell of public opinion gets behind it. And then, of course, look at how President Obama ran his campaign. I think we could probably learn some things about
The average donation was $25. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never heard of a campaign like that other than Obama's.
Right. Well, I mean, do you think that the campaign contributions made the difference, or how folks felt about it? You know.
Well, my point is just that the average person's giving that
right.
that he's not, you know, funding his entire campaign by multimillionaires.
Oh yeah.
But you know, so why aren't, you know, RG? Why isn't the public moving now? I mean, certainly, you know, if they listen to WPFW, I know they're getting a bit discouraged, and not that we want to discourage them, but you know, I mean, we're seeing
a roof over your head or figure out a job.
I also think it's because we don't have a leader.
Economy is a shambles right now for folks, and I don't know if people have the, let's say, luxury of time or the luxury of even orderly thinking anymore, you know, with things being as tight as they are. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, yeah. I do. And as Mark just said, too, I mean, we don't have the leader, but leaders appear when the leaders are needed or called for. And,
right.
You know.
So, So the people need to, people need time. They need a chance to think their agenda out. They need a time to.
You know, I think it's also. I mean,
together,
I,
you know,
I do think somehow or other we are sedated. I mean, I really honestly do.
I think the public thinks they elected Obama. They've done their job.
They've done their job, well, and the rest of their life, you know, rest of their life is back to entertainment,
right?
Or hard work to feed their families.
We don't want to go back to you know, that type of a thing. You know, just sitting being couch potatoes and watching what happens. But I don't know if do you think the old demonstration technique would work?
That's a good question. I don't know if it would or not, because I remember certainly being part of the demonstrations before the Iraq War, and you saw how much weight we had with that, and those were big, organized demonstrations.
And the reality is, could you get anybody at the demonstrations? The problem is, all too often with these type of more complicated political policy issues, finding a way to verbalize the message to people so that it's very quick and easy to digest. When things like this are very, very important, but the message has to be a bit nuanced in order to really get to the core of what the problem is. And I think part of it is, you just it's hard to find the right euphemism. It's hard to find the right little thing to say that grabs somebody. You know, there's no drill baby drill for this that'll get people to say, hey, yeah, I'm behind that.
Well, speaking of which, you know, we don't have any dental coverage. And, you know,
oh, there you go, drill baby drill.
You know, right, so maybe we should bring that back. Okay, sorry, bad segue.
You know, one of the things to do, I think, is to find, you know, we need a vehicle to ride on and to find sort of the right politician to lead the way. And it's hard to do because there are, believe it or not, there are a few honest politicians out there.
There are. Yeah.
I remember when Senator Russ Feingold, Wisconsin, ran for re-election, and he took no PAC money. And I believe he took no donation over, I think it was $100 or
something like that. Yeah.
And he barely squeaked to victory. Whereas he'd won by a lot in the past, and the lesson learned was exactly the wrong lesson, that when you do the right thing, you're punished.
Yeah,
but it was the real lesson, unfortunately. You know what I mean?
Well,
it was the wrong lesson.
But that's the way our government is working in so many ways.
Not to interrupt you, Mark,
you know, whether it's whistleblowers or whatever, I mean, you know, you do the right thing and you're screwed. I mean, it's really come down to
the
that.
The sad thing is that someone like him, who really is a reformer,
really is
trying to support public financing and get the money out of the system, they just people aren't backing it up. There are very few stories about it. It just seems to me that you need someone, and it'll probably have to be some super wealthy person, to say, look, you know, no money. I will not take money from anyone because this is wrong, and to actually start, you know, using, one I guess, their own fortune to run ads to say, stop buying our politicians.
Right.
One of the really sad things, of course, is the infirmity and the brain tumor with Ted Kennedy, because, I mean, he really did become a statesman, and a statesman specifically for some of these issues that we're talking about.
Right.
And Dodd, I know, is sort of, picked up his sword, but...
it's not the same.
It's not the same, no.
Right.
And we really, really got caught with that. Let's get back to a couple of our callers, and thank you so much for your patience. The number again is 202-588-0893. And next up is Julian. Julian, Terry Garland, and Mark here. Talk to us.
Hey, fellas, how you guys doing?
Wonderful.
We're doing okay.
Listen, I've got a lot of issues, but I can't get to them all because I know you have other callers. But one of the things I'm interested in, and I hope your guest, you guys will discuss this, not briefly, but put some time into it. I called my credit card company the other day.
Uh-oh.
And I was kind of amazed. I'd heard this on another radio station. And I heard them, I asked them what would happen if I decided to cancel my credit card. And they said, well, you're going to get a bad credit rating.
Yeah,
it's true.
Now,
yes.
My thing is,
that's true.
Of course, that's atrocious. There's no doubt about
Amen.
That.
Amen.
But what the heck can someone do about it? Are there plans right now to do anything about that in this credit card planning situation?
Not that I know of, but I mean, I think one of the things that we can do individually, which is, I know, hard for us to do, but I mean, and we talked about it, and we had a very raucous show about it, as a matter of fact, about, you know, individually doing with less. And I think that's part of this, you know, is the citizens having to make the choice that I'm just going to do with less. And, you know, whatever your situation, there's always something you can cut out. There's something you don't have to use your credit card for.
I would say live within your means rather than take
Well, okay, however.
About primarily is that if I decided to call up my credit card company tomorrow and I said, okay, I don't want to be with you guys anymore, they said that they would send in a negative report.
Yeah.
to my...
So just pay off the card and stick it in a drawer, hide it, destroy it if you want.
No, actually,
just don't use it.
Actually, you have to use it or they'll do the same thing.
No, I don't think so.
A lot of them will charge you.
Don't pay annual fees.
No, but I mean, you know, you can. I mean, I actually have some credit cards that I do this with. I mean, they literally do sit in the drawer.
Yeah,
use it, you know, periodically for a little set amount that I know I can pay off so that it doesn't affect the credit rating. And in fact, it enforces the credit rating. But they even look at things like, you know, if they raise your balance and, that you can use and then you don't use it, that will reflect on your credit card rating?
I don't know. It's a weird. We should have an expert on it because it's a million different things that.
Well, we'll take his advice. We'll research that and we'll get back to you on that. And we'll do a show about it because it is important to find out exactly what these companies are doing. 202-588-0893. We've only got time for a few more callers. We thank you for your patience, but we got time for a couple more. David, you're on the air. This is Terry, Mark, and Garland.
Hey, folks. Good evening.
Hi, David. Hello.
Okay, look, the first thing, and I have no solution for it, is I think we need to break up the two-party system. I have no solution for this.
Well, we're all with you there. We don't we don't either.
But I don't think I don't think you should give up on working within the system while you're trying to reform it. I'm okay with trying to reform it. But
the Republicans were a third party back in the 1850s.
Yeah,
it
a long time ago.
True. But the Whigs falling apart.
But so much has changed culturally.
Yeah,
then.
I agree, here's the question.
A progressive person in the Democratic Party. I mean, you can throw out if you don't like a certain Democratic person.
And then, David, we always get to this question, and I mean, not to belittle what you're saying, I certainly agree with you, but then the question always becomes one of two things. What should we do versus what can we do? Because a lot of times we say, yes, we should have a third party where we should do a lot of things, but then we get back to the reality of what can we do to try to
Time because I didn't trust the voters.
And I think one of the things that we can do, though, to me it's astounding that there isn't some unification between the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, the Progressive Party. There are issues that are actually in common. I've sat here and had guests, from each one of those on the air, and there are things that they agree in. And for them not to unite in some way, at least with maybe some candidates to give some strength, astounds me. Because
there was kind of that. When Ross Perot ran and created the Reform Party, the Reform Party meant a million different things. I mean, it seems like its members could say, yeah, I'm a member of the Reform Party. I believe in this. And then
kind of like the original
and the
Republican
opposite,
Party.
And they believe in something else. And then, Perot went crazy. And
well,
that thing,
not only did he go crazy, but he still got 19% of the vote, which was a huge amount.
I think it was 14.
No, it was 19. No, it was 19.
It was announced 19.
Was it really 19?
Worked for Ross. I'm sorry,
Okay.
And but then what happened again right there is that's when corporate America moved in, where the Republican two parties moved in, took away the debates from the League of Women Voters, set up this private corporation to handle the debates, which now keeps it so narrow and so closed that a third party candidate couldn't get in there if their life depended on it.
And the funny thing we're talking about is originally the Republican Party was what, the Whigs?
Yep.
So-called
Know-nothing,
the Whigs, the know-nothings that they called themselves, the abolitionists. It was a kind of a weird group that came together that Lincoln kind of had to walk some very close chalk lines to keep that kind of loose coalition together.
And that's part of the problem, too, that I've seen with other activist organizations, as long as we're putting the blame on everybody, is that so many activist organizations really have their own agenda, and they stick to that agenda come hell or high water, and that's the only agenda they're interested in.
And coalitions are the only way to win anything.
Coalitions are the only way. So this goes for all these little parties as well as individuals in their neighborhoods, et cetera. And it has to be done.
That's a great point, an excellent point, because there are a lot of progressive organizations that are out there, beating the bushes and screaming and yelling about what they should do, the right or the Republicans, whoever they want to say. But instead of saying, well, we know what they are going to do. Well, what can we do? We can work together.
Yeah, maybe your issue is the environment, and someone else's issue is credit card fraud, and someone else's issue is health care.
Yes, exactly.
But we can. But, so if you're an environmentalist, support us on health care. If you believe in public health care, support.
Or even on a single issue. I was at a seminar at UDC, which was a great seminar a number of years back. I was involved with some economic issues, and it was a seminar on poverty. And there were something like 180 different groups there, representing various organizations and various groups working on the poverty issue. you think they could come together and then, you know, form a common stand and take a common action? No, they all preferred to keep their own agenda. They got to form coalitions.
And
they
here and there, you know, we see some Green Party candidates getting elected in some of the local elections. You know, imagine if you take, as what we're saying, you take some of these other groups and add them together, you're going to get more third-party people
in.
And just find the common ground if you're all, say, progressive, or if you're not progressive, and if you're all, you know, far right, whatever.
You two may disagree with me, but I haven't given up on the Democratic Party just yet. I think that we can reform from within the Democratic Party. You can have primaries, you can run a progressive candidate, and get out some of the Democrats in name only, and we shouldn't...
I'm in agreement with you on that, Mark. I don't disagree at all.
You know, this is part of the key, though. I mean, what we really have to do is also find a way, and whether it's leaders or whether maybe we should be doing more in a more positive vein on shows like this... of inspiring people. I mean, like the Democratic primary in Virginia just a few weeks ago was a significant primary. And the fact that only 6% of the voters got out and voted for it is shameful, because you had some really strong candidates. You had some strong choices to make. And that's the kind of election where a vote really did matter. And people did not get out and vote.
But by the same token, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of corporate money to be made, so you didn't see much about it on the local news, did you? Every now and then there was a 1 or 2 minute blurb.
Yeah, it's true. Well, there were plenty of commercials, that's for sure. Hey, Paul, thanks for your patience.
Terry, I think Paul's next.
I said Paul.
Oh, you said, oh, for his patience. I thought you were, sorry.
No, I don't want to talk to patience.
Go right ahead. We got a little bit of time. Take Paul,
okay,
please.
Paul, you're on the air. Jump in.
I thought you were saying goodbye to Paul.
I would like to speak to one of the points you just brought up and earlier, and that was that you said the Obama administration, the average contributor only contributes about an average of $25. If that was the case, then you were also saying that since Obama raised over $800 million, that he then had 32 million contributors. No way did he have 32 million contributors.
No, I'm saying the median is actually the better word to use. The mid contributor, in other words, half the contributors gave more than 25, and half gave less.
If it was medium, it would have been at least 10 million people who contributed to his campaign.
Well,
if
the fact
medium was 25,000.
The fact is, you're right. You're both right. You're both right here. I mean, he did have an extraordinary number of small campaign contributions. He also did have a lot of corporate money contributions.
Yeah,
you know, he had both.
Money. In fact, if he had 2 million 25 contributors, he would only have $50 million out of his $800 million.
Paul, why do I have the feeling you're sitting there with a calculator?
Yeah, right.
You're good at this. I mean,
I think it was a lot more than 2 million, honestly.
Yeah, I remember when it was three at one point.
The kind of misconception that people have in trying to make the argument that he's a people's person, that he's not a corporate leader, he's not a corporate this and that and the other. And he liked to dwell on the part that he had small amount of contributors. I mean, small contributors. And I agree. He broke the record on having small contributors. But in breaking the record, he still had overwhelming, most of his contributors were major contributors.
Well, most of the money, not most of the contributors.
Yes. And let me just say this.
Point taken.
Let me say this. I was about eight people. Because I gave at least eight times. So the numbers aren't, you know what I mean? People like me who might have gave 8 or 10 times, 20, 50,
you know,
or 100
this is
here.
What, this is
most of the contributors
really...
were small. Most of the money was big. That's the math.
But Paul's got a point. And, you know, one of the things that discourages me, I mean, you know, I went out and canvassed, and I'm sure a lot of other people did as well. And, you know, there was kind of a movement behind this man. I mean, there certainly were a herd of volunteers.
Kind of a movement.
Well, yeah, I mean, but there were volunteers out canvassing,
right.
You know, and that has somehow either disappeared. And, you know, I remember
he's trying to bring it back. You know, he's already appealed with the health care proposal. He's already appealed to his email list. He wants to see that kind of grassroots effort again.
Well, then he better do some more leadership. I mean, frankly, because, I mean, he's got to inspire those of us who are out there saying, okay, you're going to be different. You're going to take a different stance. You're going to stand up for it, and you're going to fight for it. And we're not seeing it. We're seeing corporate America.
Well, not me. I would say this, that I'm seeing a lot of it. I'm seeing more of it than I've seen by any president in my lifetime. In my lifetime, I've yet to see a president take some of the stances that he's taken. Now, am I going to say that every single stance that he takes that I'm completely in agreement with? That's not what I expected.
No, but that leads to the point of our whole show today. He has taken some stances. He has addressed more issues in a shorter period of time than probably any president of the United States. And any issue he addresses is immediately swamped with lobbyists.
Of course.
Who tear it apart.
Of course.
Who put
because he's
going to
take
money.
Listen. Yeah. If they're making trillions of dollars off of us, off our backs, and he's going to take that away with a public option, if the government is there, where do all the middlemen go? All those people that work in health insurance, they lose their jobs.
Yeah.
Let's face it, because they, you know, every health dollar you're paying for,
one third of it's going to insurance companies. Got it.
Right.
Every insurance company person that gets laid off is immediately automatically enlisted in the Army.
There you go.
There we go. It solves the problem.
Or teachers or Peace Corps.
No. Give them to the Army. We're talking insurance people here. Hey, we've run out of time here. It's been great, as always, talking to you guys. And talking to you guys, Mark and Garland, and
that's
as well
me.
As the listeners. And quickly tell us how to contact you guys.
Well, if you want
to
get in contact with me, probably the easiest way is Facebook, Garland Nixon, G-A-R-L-A-N-D, N-I-X-O-N. Just look for me on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, I'm on Facebook, too. Mark Levine, M-A-R-K-L-E-V-I-N-E. But if you want to check out my show. It's RadioInsideScoop.com.
This is your show.
This show will be on my website. If you missed part of today, you can hear it on the website. And also, there was a show last night on Africa, which you might want to check out.
We're just demanding a little loyalty here from the Raucous Caucus. This is Terry D. Kester. WPFW.org is the best way to reach me. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., join me on What's at Stake. Is there a way out of our nation's quandaries? The same issues, but does it involve a little more understanding of our history? Does it involve a little more understanding of our theology and our spirituality? Both of those directions are going to be pursued tomorrow morning at What's at Stake at 10 o'clock. We'll be back next Tuesday with the Raucous Caucus on Dialogue.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next Tuesday at 7 for another edition of Dialogue.